There is one player on the Titans defense who could make or break the season. If he's good, the defense will be awesome. If he's not good, a lot of question marks. We're talking about Femi Oladejo, Titans second year defensive end. Today, this is the Music City Audible. Let's get to it. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Music City Audible, a Tennessee Titans podcast. I'm your host, Justin Graver, full-time NFL podcast producer for Odyssey, and joining me, as always, the managing editor of Titan Sized, the publisher of NFL Draft on SI, my co-host, Justin Mello. Justin, today, there's a thing happening with the Titans fans, and that thing is that...
I think a lot of people are forgetting about Femi.
And so we're going to talk about him today because we don't want people to forget about Femi. How's it going, Justin?
I just got memories, flashbacks of like Forgot About Dre by Dr. Dre and Eminem. When I hear that, I think people are forgetting about Femi. I want to hear Eminem do a course saying Forget About Femi. I'm doing well, doing well. We've been planning this episode for a little while. I know you. I think you teased it last week when news came out that Javon Kearse, the legend, the freak himself, is going to be working with Femi Oladejo at Titans training camp. I believe he said he's going to wait for it because he wants the pads to be on, which I think is smart because nothing looks the same in t-shirt and shorts as it does when the pads are on. So yeah, Femi Oladejo, good player focused episode today. One of the first question marks, I would arguably say, on Mike Borgonzi's early resume. So it's important, you know, him going into year two, that he shows something and kind of starts changing the perception around that pick in the second round.
Yeah, he fractured his leg during week six of last season and missed the rest of the season, which is just a bummer for a rookie, you know, six games in. And a lot of people remember that game as the potential Femi breakout game. It was like the first game that Femi really started to show flashes of his potential. He was getting in the backfield early, making plays in the run game. I think maybe had a pressure in the passing game. Like, it was like, is this what we've been waiting, you know, five-ish weeks to see? A lot of people will also remember that Femi was an inside linebacker, off-the-ball linebacker for most of his college career. It wasn't until his final season at UCLA, four games into the year, that they started to say, I think we need somebody. We need somebody else on the outside, outside linebacker on the end spot, the edge spot. Femi, you're the guy that's going to transition there mid-season in your last season of college, potentially, you know, change his entire career in football as he moves to defensive end. And that's a real transition. And it takes a while to learn the nuances of the new position to the point where you can contribute. I also think on the Javon Kearse note, which I want to come back to, Justin, I think, and I don't know this to be true, but, you know, last Thursday was the first open OTA practice for the Titans this year, and Femi was working on a side field with trainers. I just mentioned he suffered a fractured leg last season that ended his year prematurely. It's possible that he's not fully back to working on the field in team periods and stuff like that. Like, we don't know how much participation he had last week because there were three practices and only one was open to the media. And I don't know if it's like, oh, it's the third one out of this week, maybe take it easy today. Or if it's like, has he been on the side field the whole time? We don't know. Javon Kearse may know that he's not ready to like work full speed yet. And thinking if I come during training camp, then we'll be able to get the most out of it. But anyway, I want to come back to Javon Kearse and Femi after we talk about what his coaches think of him, Aaron Whitecotton, Robert Saleh. We're going to get into all that today as we break down why Femi is so important to this defense as a guy that, you know, the Titans have this massive hole at edge. They've had it forever. They spend a first-round pick on Keldrick Falk, but he's a guy that, you know, maybe inside-outside hybrid. We don't know how much third-down edge rusher he's going to play. So the Titans still have this hole at edge. They trade for Jermaine Johnson. That fills one of the two spots. They lost their top three most productive pass rushers from a year ago, right? Or their top three ends, I guess, from a year ago. Arden Key, Jihad Ward, Draymond Jones, who they traded mid-season. So like the group that entered last year, 2025, as a Titans end group, totally different from where they're at now. This massive hole will close if Femi Oladejo, a second-round pick, turns into an every-down starter, just an above average level. He doesn't have to come in and be a Pro Bowl superstar, but if he can be like a player that plays at an above average starter level, then he solves a massive problem for the Titans. So that's why I think he is such a key player. We're going to talk about whether or not we think he can break out today.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into that discussion. If you don't mind, I might start by sort of just recapping his rookie year and a little bit of what you said. Like, they draft him in the second round. I would go as far as say immediately wasn't like a super popular pick, I think, from the get-go with Titans fans. Because obviously, you know, potential is a scary word, and I think this fan base has been burned a lot. You go back to Doriel Green Beckham, Kevin Dodd, like all kinds of guys that maybe had that word attached to their pre-draft profile that didn't live up. You did a good job summarizing. Like, he didn't switch till edge, didn't switch to edge until midway through his final year in college. He talks about like the Senior Bowl being key to his development at the position. It just goes to show you how far behind the eight ball he was, right? Like, when you're really developing at a position at the Senior Bowl, when everyone else is showing up there, typically having played that position for multiple years, you're a developmental prospect, right? So Titans, they go ahead and they take him. He had a bunch of pre-draft interest. I did a lot of pre-draft stories with him. He's a great guy. I talked to him so often throughout that pre-draft process. He's so fun, energetic, bubbly. He wanted to keep in touch, like just pretty rare for a prospect, in all honesty. I had such good experiences with him. And he gets the camp, obviously, as we've covered, he's raw. Six games, I mean, that injury was so devastating, right? Because a guy who's trying to develop and really needed every rep he could get to suffer the injury, he hadn't even played 250 defensive snaps, you know, before he suffered the injury. 13 tackles, 7 pressures, 0 sacks, credited with Pro Football Focus, essentially had him graded out in the 50s in every department. His overall grade, his pass rushing grade, his run stopping grade, this is a guy that needed to play. And the fractured leg injury prevented that from happening to the degree that we needed it to happen, right? 241 snaps, not nearly enough. And as you said, some people believe that Raiders game before the injury was looking like his best game. I think we're probably getting a little carried away with that, and to be honest with you, in this fan base. And the injury happened early enough that you're really talking about flashes. Now, I also thought when the injury happened, I'm like, that's going to end his season. Maybe this is neither here nor there, but the Titans seemed optimistic that he might come back. And I was like, really? From a fractured leg injury that happened in mid-October? I doubt it, kind of thing. And he never did end up coming back. I think to should have been to no surprise. But obviously now heading into year two, new head coach, all new coaching staff, position coach, a new scheme, a new system, also new principles, right? Like, it seems like, you know, the 3-4 defense last year where they had a nose tackle in Tavondre Sweat, now it's going to be more of a base 4-3 under Robert Saleh. So it's like, not only is the coaching staff in the system, but the whole scheme, everything seems different. So big offseason ahead here for Femi Oladeji.
Yeah, I'm glad you're starting there because it's a great segue into my first clip that we're going to play here. Robert Saleh has been asked about and has spoken about Femi Oladeji many times since taking over the Titans head coaching job. We got a great drop out of it.
I think a lot of people are forgetting about Femi.
Out of one of those questions. And here, that's going to be included in one of the answers we'll play, not this first one. But this is from the Combine, when Saleh was being asked about defensive ends. You know, back then there was a lot of thought that the Titans would be taking an Arvell Reese or David Bailey with their pick, right, back at the Combine. And talking about just the defensive end room, and here was a question asked about second-year player Femi Oladeji and Robert Saleh. This is, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong in the comments, like and subscribe, but I believe this is the first time that Saleh spoke about Femi Oladeji since becoming the head coach of the Titans.
Yeah, you know, with a young man like Femi, it wasn't that he was just being evaluated by 3-4 teams. We evaluated him as a 4-3 defensive end whose hand was in the ground. And, you know, for him, he's got all the talent in the world. He's got length, he's got speed, he's got pass rush ability, he plays with violence. He's a good football player. And, you know, for him, it's just going to be transferring to getting your hand in the ground and going vertical every snap rather than having to think about coverages and all that. So, obviously, there's going to be a learning curve for him even in that role, and there's going to be a lot of coaching and a lot of work on his part to get himself better every single day. And I think he's got the mindset and the physical ability to do that.
So clearly evaluating him as an end in a 4-3 system. You know, San Francisco drafted Micah Williams early last year, right? Comparisons made between Keldrick Fox, you know, body type and what Micah Williams was for San Francisco last year, but they were looking at defensive ends. So they evaluated Femi Oladeji, and despite him only playing, what, over a little over half a season as an end, that's how San Francisco was viewing him. So this move, position move for Femi, may have been something that was always going to happen for him with his body type, his athleticism, his physicality, And the fact that it happened while he was still at UCLA may have actually helped speed up his development, because there's a chance he gets to the NFL and teams are like, you know, we don't really see you as an inside linebacker. We want to move you to edge. It takes 2 years to develop him into that role. Regardless, it happened early for him at UCLA, and that's how Robert Saleh and the Titans view him. That's the first time he spoke about it. Even after that, there were still some questions of, like, is he going to play a little off the ball in this system? Is he not? But it's pretty clear to me, based on that and some clips we're going to play in a second, that he is in the mix for the at a defensive end spot in this 4-3 defense, where he won't be asked to drop into coverages anymore. It's going to be all about getting upfield, attacking upfield, which I will talk more about Saleh's scheme specifically with regards to getting upfield in a moment. But yeah, that was the first time we heard Saleh speak about Femi.
I'm just going to say something. I can't help myself, folks. One of the reasons I love this show so much, and I hope you love it too, Graver might know where I'm going. I knew he had clips. I hadn't seen them. I don't know what clips Graver cut. I didn't plan my opening monologue. And the fact that I'm talking about, you know, switching off to the 4-3 defense, and you've got that clip, I had no idea. That times up so perfectly. And it's interesting. I didn't know. I heard it at the time, but I don't remember it now in May. It's interesting that Robert Saleh and the 49ers, you know, had evaluated him throughout that pre-draft process as a 4-3 defensive end with his hand in the dirt. Funny how life works. Robert Saleh gets the head coaching job here in Tennessee, and that's the transition, you know, Femi is now tasked with making this offseason.
And it is going to be the wide nine spot for Femi. And if you want confirmation on that, well, here's Robert Saleh, asked by Paul Kaharsky. This is the morning after the draft. And now, again, I just mentioned how Keldrick Falk has that body type that's sort of inside-outside versatility. And basically, Paul Kaharsky was asking Robert, he was like, hey, coach, you have all these guys that are like bigger bodies that can play end on early downs and bump inside on pass rushing downs. But what about the guys that are actually staying or playing outside on those pass rushing downs? Like, who are your wide nines? I know you want to rotate guys, but a majority of snaps, like, who do you see right now in the wide nine role on third down? And this was his, and he said, how do you sort that out? And I mentioned that because the beginning of this answer will make more sense, knowing that the question was posed as, how do you sort out who's going to be at the wide nine spot?
One, that's why Aaron Wycon gets paid so much money. But no, in all seriousness, you know, I know the two obvious ones are Jacob Martin and Jermaine, but I think a lot of people are forgetting about Femi. I think he was drafted last year. He's a talented young man. You know, we're going to do our best to try to give him every opportunity to be successful as a wide nine edge rusher on third down. And we feel really good about the rotation that's being built here. I think Borgo's done a great job collecting a group of men that have different skill sets and have versatility to them.
Every opportunity to be a wide nine on third down. And Justin, really quick, you thought of Forget About Dre when I played that clip initially. I thought, as a Mavs fan, and there may be a tiny, tiny subset of our audience that overlap Mavs and Titans who will get this reference. A few years ago, the Mavs didn't have a point guard. This is before Kyrie Irving. And they had this guy, Frank Ntilikina, on the roster. And like, he'd played a little bit towards the end of last season, showed some flashes, but he'd been like a journeyman guy, didn't play like for very hit. He'd been around the league a bit and hadn't really stuck anywhere. And they're asking Jason Kidd, who just got fired. We're happy in Mavs land. What are you doing at the point guard? Like, who's going to play? Who's going to handle the ball, basically? And he's like rattling these names, and Jason Kidd goes, and a lot of people forget about Frank. And that became a meme for Mavs fans. A lot of people forget about Frank. So I'm hoping that this becomes more of like a, hey, Justin, guess who had the first sack of the game?
I think a lot of people are forgetting about Femi.
And this is what we're doing on Sundays. And it doesn't become a meme where like he's invisible and then we're playing it as a meme on why he's invisible. Because people, anyway. Wide nine in the rotation alongside Jacob Martin, Jermaine Johnson. Femi Oladejo is the third guy in the mix.
I think the reason you're more optimistic on this topic than I am, in all honesty, is that's a lot of competition at that spot and only so many snaps to go around. And guess what? The other two guys who are mentioned in the mix at that spot have both played for Robert Saleh before. Right. And Jacob Martin and Jermaine Johnson. And one of them is former first round pick of Robert Saleh's and Jermaine Johnson, who they traded for and they were willing to trade to Vondre Sweat to go get. So I think Jermaine Johnson's going to be the primary wide nine in this defense, and everyone else is going to need to make the most of limited opportunities in truth. And with Johnson, of course, you know, he's coming off second year removed from the Achilles, didn't play a very good year with the New York Jets last season. So it is within the realm of possibility that if he doesn't get all the way back to his pre-injury form, that, and he's ineffective in truth, because he was kind of ineffective last year, that there are going to be more opportunities at that spot for someone like Jacob Martin or Femi Oladejo to exploit. But as of right now, I don't have a ton of confidence because of how much competition and how many bodies are at that spot. And like, we're not talking about, like, can Femi come here and have a 10-sack season? He's just got to play and contribute and carve out a role for himself. Now, what's interesting is when they're rushing the passer on third down, and I'm not trying to get ahead of myself here, but he talked about third down in that answer, right? It's like, I don't think Keldrick Falk's going to be on the field a lot to start with on third down. I think John Franklin Myers is probably at D tackle, I hope, on third down with Jeffrey Simmons. So who are those two spots, the two rush spots, belong to? I think it's safe to say one of them belongs to Jermaine Johnson. If the other doesn't belong to Keldrick Falk, I'm talking strictly third down pass rush, could that be where it's Femi Oladejo and Jermaine Johnson both on the field at the same time? And if Femi doesn't win that spot, then I think they'll be perfectly comfortable playing Jacob Martin and Jermaine Johnson on the field at the same time. So there's a lot of competition here, and it's not a foregone conclusion in my mind that Femi's going to have some great impact this season.
Well, I have a rebuttal to that that I will save because we got to take a break. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. More Femi Oladejo, the effects of Aaron Whitecotton as his coach, and Javon Kearse training him in training camp coming up in a few months. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We talk about mental health more openly now, but asking for help can still feel hard, and BetterHelp's latest research confirms it.
BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from actually doing so. What can we as a society do to close this gap between believing in mental health support and actually seeking it out?
Well, we can start by encouraging each other to seek support when we need it. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, you should know that BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform.
All you have to do to get started is fill out a short questionnaire, and BetterHelp takes care of matching you with a therapist. The best part? If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from any of BetterHelp's tailored recommendations.
Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Welcome back, everyone. Justin, my rebuttal is, I feel like, and maybe you're not, so you tell me, but I feel like you're underrating the amount of rotation that's going to happen along this defensive line. I mean, Robert Saleh has said, and I don't have this quote, I wish I did now, but Robert Saleh has said, or maybe it was Gus Bradley even, I don't remember, somebody in charge of the defense for the Titans said that they don't want guys playing more than 60% of the snaps. Like, there's going to be, it's not like offensive line, for example, where like whoever starts plays the whole game and that's it, or quarterback or whatever. I think that there's going to be a lot of guys getting a lot of opportunity here. Like, I think the thing about this defense is everyone's going to get a chance to go make a play. And whether or not they're effective or not in their opportunities is obviously up to them. And so I think, you know, the beginning of the season, I could definitely see like your starters or the main guys out there on third down are, yeah, Jermaine Johnson and either Keldrick Falk or Jacob Martin. And I only put Keldrick Falk there pecking order wise because he's a first round pick. But I could also see him not even being in the mix at the beginning of the year because he's still, you know, rookie.
It's interesting though, sometimes. Because not to cut you off, but on early downs, I feel like they're going to want that kind of body type. Like, I don't
agree.
Know that it's right. Like, it's not, I think Jacob Martin, Femi, like they're almost a little similar ish to each other that, I think they're going to want a bit like Keldrick Falk's bigger than all of them, and he's longer than all of them, and he could set the edge. I mean, we've never seen him play in the NFL, but you get where I'm going.
But he's a run defender first right now, and I think that that's one of the reasons they drafted him, and then you don't necessarily have to put John Franklin Myers on the end because you have Keldrick Falk to do it. I agree. But as far as the wide nine rule goes, like, it's going to be Jermaine, it's going to be Jacob Martin, it's going to be Femi. They're all going to get snaps. They're all going to play. And at the beginning of the year, Femi might get 8 snaps, right? But if he does something with those 8 snaps, or injuries will always happen at some point, or maybe they end up in a lot more third downs one week because they're playing a good offense and they can't get off the field or something like that. Like, he's going to have more opportunities as the season goes along if he takes advantage of them. And by week 10, he could be playing 25 snaps. And by week 17, he could be playing 35 snaps. Like, that's the kind of year. I think if you're envisioning the best case scenario breakout year for Femi, it looks something like that, because I don't think he's going to get the opportunity to play 45 snaps in week one just because, like you said, it is a crowded room. But at the same time, everyone's going to get to play. Everyone in the 8 or 9 guys that they have at the top of the depth chart from the interior and exterior of the defensive line, they're all going to get to play quite a bit.
I can see why you use that as a rebuttal to my point. But I'll say this. I wasn't underrating the rotational aspect, because it was actually the next point I was going to make, because they've already got like 9-10 D linemen on this roster that are like almost like shoehorn fits, right, for the 53-man final roster. And we haven't even mentioned Jalen Harrell, by the way, who can play one of those spots a little bit too. I wasn't underrating the rotation. I think I said a few weeks ago, like, they've got 9-10. Solomon Thomas is going to make this team, and Jordan Elliott, and they drafted Jackie Marshall, like, across the D-line, right? 9-10 yeah. guys. I'm not underrating it, because I'm factoring it in when I say, like, it's hard for me to see the path, right, to, like, a really true, fantastic sophomore year, because all these guys are going to play. Well, what does that create? It creates limited opportunities, right? And for him specifically, like, as much as I believe they're all going to rotate, and I don't think it's going to be a 33-33-33 split, right? Like, I do think Jermaine Johnson's probably, because of his relationship with Robert Saleh, his veteran experience, he's had success in this league. I imagine he's first up, right, in the pecking order. And then I think who's next up is probably a true competition, you know, between Jacob Martin and Femi. And I also think, like, going back to the previous point, I don't think Jermaine Johnson is a, like, if he's not playing well, then he's going to get replaced as the first guy in the pecking order, right? I'm saying, who's going to start off as the lead guy in that pecking order? I assume it's Jermaine Johnson. And then after that, it really is a competition between Jacob Martin and Femi Oladejo. Who's next up when Jermaine Johnson's off the field, and how are we going to rotate number 2 and number 3? And by the way, it's close enough, like I just said, if number 2 and number 3 are playing their socks off, then they are going to become number 1 in this rotational pecking order, right? But the point is, there's going to be limited opportunities because of how often they're going to rotate and how many bodies they have competing for reps at that spot, that you really do have to be efficient and maximize your opportunities, your reps when you get them. That, you know, it's tough to see the dominant breakout path for Femi Oladejo with the way that, you know, with A, how his rookie season went, and B, with how much this D-line is going to rotate under Robert Saleh and Aaron Whitecotton.
Yeah, I think there is going to be a lot of rotation, and that's the big thing. I'm looking right now at the 2023 New York Jets, who went 7-10 under Robert Saleh. That was the year after Aaron Rodgers tore his Achilles. It was the year before Jermaine Johnson, or the year that Jermaine Johnson tore his Achilles, and when the year he had 7.5 sacks. He played 65% of snaps that year on the defensive side of the ball. I don't know the alignments. I'm not looking at alignments right now. Quinnen Williams, you know, all-pro Quinnen Williams, only played 68% of the snaps that year.
Is that what's in line for Jeffrey Simmons?
Like, he was an all-pro on 68% snaps because he, in those snaps that he did get to play, he was, you know, he made an impact. Bryce Huff at defensive end played 42% of snaps. Carl Lawson, who may or may not have gotten hurt that year, only played 9% of snaps. Quentin Jefferson played 41% of snaps. Michael Clemens, who's like one of those bigger bodied guys, inside outside kind of guy, 32% of snaps. John Franklin Myers, 55% of snaps. These guys play a lot of snaps, and like I could pull up the exact number. I mean, I have the exact number here, but I don't think it's going to mean a lot to you. Bryce Huff, 480 snaps. John Franklin Myers, 627 snaps. Jermaine Johnson, 748 snaps. Yeah, I think percent is an easier way to look at it. But when you look at the production of that room that year, The team leader in sacks was Bryce Huff with 10, Jermaine Johnson, 7.5, Quentin Jefferson, 6, Quinnen Williams, 5.5, Solomon Thomas, 5, John Franklin Myers, 3.5, Will McDonald, who I believe was a rookie that season,
yes, 3, he was.
Quincy Williams at the inside linebacker spot, Blitzer, 2 sacks, Jalen Holmes, 1 sack, Al Woods, 1 sack, CJ Mosley, 0.5 sack, Jordan Whitehead, who's a safety, 0.5 sack. Like, it's pretty, it's... There's a lot of sacks that go around. It's not concentrated like a Myles Garrett type player who gets 18 or whatever, and then the next guy gets 6. It's like 10, 7.5, 6, 5.5, 5. It's almost what I think Titans fans might be used to, because that's kind of how it's been without a true dominant edge rusher on this team. The sacks have been sort of give and take or divided up evenly with Jeffrey Simmons leading the way.
I think it's going to need to be similar for them to be effective, because I think, you know, Jeffrey Simmons, by the way, like, can they really afford to only play him, you know, 65% of snaps? I'm not convinced. I know he's 68, I think it was, but I'm not convinced that that's the case. If it is, that's a good thing, right? You keep him healthier, keep him fresh. He's getting up there in age a little bit too. Talking about giving him a new contract, if you can keep him effective for longer because he's playing a little less, then that would be a nice outcome. I just remember all the years they said they were going to play Harold Landry less and they could never afford to. Like, you know, I don't know that they could afford to play Jeffrey Simmons less. But the way I envision this room being successful, it's Jeffrey Simmons having 8 to 10 sacks. It's John Franklin Myers having, you know, 7 to 9 sacks. Jermaine Johnson having 6-7 sacks. Keldrick Falk has 4. Femi Oladejo has 4. Jacob Martin has 5. You know what I mean? Like, that's the way. Jalen Harrell has 2 or 3. Solomon Thomas and Jordan Elliott pitch in with 2 or 3 apiece. Like, that's the way, that's the realistic pathway for this D-line to be good and dominant while rotating.
How many snaps or percentage-wise do you think Jeffrey Simmons played last year? All-pro year. What do you think he was at?
He didn't miss any games due to injury, right? I don't think.
He played 15 games last year. So
he did miss 2 games. So that plays a big role. You got to factor that in. What was the final percentage?
Final percentage for Jeffrey Simmons last year, 72.01% of defensive snaps.
That's 75 plus, I assume, if he doesn't miss 2 games.
Well, I can look at the game by game and just look at the percentage down the line. 84% in week 1, 83 in week 2, 78, 93, 94, 86%. Only played 18% of snaps in week 7, missed weeks 8 and 9.
I assume. There you go. Yeah.
And missed weeks 8 and 9. 82% of snaps when he came back. 95, 81, 87, 90, 86, 96, and 59% of snaps in the season finale when the season was over and Cam Ward got hurt. So, yeah, I mean, you look at the season long, you're like, oh, hey, he didn't play that much. You look at it game by game, it's like, no, when he was playing, he was
80%,
playing.
80% plus every week. So yeah. Can they get him down to 65, 68? I mean, if TBD, right? Like, we know this defense likes to rotate. I don't know how much you're rotating the best D tackle in football, though.
Yeah. I mean, hey, Quinnen Williams was that when he played for Saleh. And yeah, I didn't go game by game looking at Quinnen Williams either. But, that, you know, there's a chance that they take him down to about 70, 75 maybe. I mean, I could see them wanting to really rotate this defensive line, which brings us back to Femi Oladejo getting his opportunities. Justin, on Thursday of last week at OTAs, Robert Saleh talked about Femi again. We mentioned it on Friday's show. We mentioned that we were going to save it for this show. Let's take a listen to what Robert Saleh's most recent comments about Femi Oladejo.
I think when you look at someone like Femi, who's, I mean, he checks every box. He looks unbelievable walking off the bus, right? And he's got great length. He's got great speed. For him, it's going to come down to putting on pads and playing with the violence that we ask for out of the defensive line. Different than a 3-14, and it's not to say that he's not a violent person. He can play with violence, but you're not really asked when you're just sitting there setting edges and the way outside linebackers play. We get off the ball, we're in your face. There is a learning curve. So right now it's more just fine tuning his movements with regards to pass rush and understanding pad level and the way we ask our guys to get off. But the true growth will happen once training camp hits.
So that takes me to 2 points. True growth will happen once training camp hits. Stick a pin in that part of it, Justin. I mentioned earlier we were going to talk about the difference playing in this defense versus playing in Denard Wilson's defense last year. And this is the difference, is that the defensive linemen in Robert Saleh's defensive scheme, and Gus Bradley's for that matter, their primary objective on every snap is to get up the field, penetrate the backfield, defeat a block and move the line of scrimmage, reset it in the backfield. Whereas a lot of defenses will ask in the run game, especially, well, and the ends especially, or the time, I mean, everyone on the line, a lot of defenses will ask those guys to hold their position. Like, instead of shedding the block right away, to hold that block and read the play. And if the ball carrier is coming towards your gap, a lot of times you're defending two gaps when you're playing like this, an inside and an outside gap, where you have one guy that you're lined up on one, like over him, as opposed to lining up in a gap, you're lined up on a man, and you got to hold that block, and whichever way the ball carrier goes, shed and go make the tackle. In Robert Saleh's defense, you're not sitting there holding a block, waiting to react to where the ball carrier is going. You are getting upfield. You are creating havoc in the backfield. You are muddying up lanes and gaps, and everybody is doing this. So you're worried about getting upfield. You're not worried about defending a specific gap or shedding a block. So that's going to be a change for Femi Oladejo that I think can help him, because it simplifies things. There's not as much reading and reacting. It's more about just playing aggressive. You're not reacting to what the offense is doing. You're putting the offense on their heels. We're coming at you, and you're going to react to us as opposed to us reacting to you. And that's the biggest thing that he's going to have to learn. It's a new technique that he didn't play last year. And I would guess didn't play at UCLA. I don't know. But that upfield attacking thing, I think, can help him a lot. And so I'm excited to see the defense in general playing with that kind of aggression, especially we just talked about Jeffrey Simmons, a guy like him. We know we can defeat a block. Remember the sack he had on CJ Stroud last year, where he was in the backfield in half an instant? Like, he can defeat a block quickly. So having all these guys attacking upfield right away, it's going to be interesting for Femi to adjust to. But once he does, I think that will really allow him to take advantage of his physical skill set.
Well, I hope it doesn't take him too long to adjust, to be blunt, because you're removing the complicated aspects of playing the position that he initially struggled with last year, and you're asking him to rely on some of the buzzwords Robert Saleh's used to describe him. Speed, athleticism, violence, aggression, right? Like, just play fast, play physical, and rely on his natural ability to make plays. If anything, there's a learning curve to everything, I understand, but it's something that should really help him, and he should be able to catch on rather quickly.
Yeah, and he did say you probably won't see this growth until training camp. And Justin, I mentioned it at the very top of the show. There may be a reason you don't see this growth, and there may be a reason it takes Femi a little bit longer. As you were just saying, you hope it doesn't. But if he's not healthy yet, if he's still working back from his leg injury, we don't know the status of him right now. Like, I'll be curious to see the next open practice is this Friday. I'll be curious to see what his participation level is. You know, a week later, a few practices later. We don't know if they're on like a practice 2 days, rest one day, or work with trainers on the side field one day. We don't know what kind of rhythm or schedule they're on. We're not going to know probably for a while, so we will likely have to wait for training camp. But it's interesting because that is when Javon Kearse will be attending Titans training camp to help Femi Oladejo, specifically Femi Oladejo, work on pass rushing tips from the freak himself, Javon Kearse, the best pass rusher in Tennessee Titans history. Was on the Super Bowl team that went to the Super Bowl. I mean, I don't know if this is going to help. If this means anything. Like, sometimes we overreact to stuff like this, and I'm definitely doing that right now. But I will say, I'd rather Javon Kearse be out there giving Femi Oladejo pass rushing tips than him not be there.
I'm with you. 14 and a half sacks as a rookie, nicknamed the freak. And I think the other thing, of course, it's about him getting healthy, but I also think there's probably an element to this of, like, I think Robert Saleh said the other day jokingly, like, something about OTAs, not having pads on, things are going to change. Like, I don't want Javon Kearse to help Femi Oladejo in a t-shirt and shorts, because we know he's athletic and he's going to look really fast and fun. Like, no. When the pads come on, he's got to go up against offensive linemen on game day at Titans practice who are in pads. The ball game changes. That's when he's got to be helped. That's when he's got to learn to be more effective and rush the passer. It's with the pads on. So I'm glad Javon Kearse will be out there for training camp working on tips of the trade. Hopefully it helps. Listen, Robert Saleh, Aaron White, Cotton, defense, Javon Kearse, like, I'm hoping everything kind of comes together. The onus will be on Femi, right, to take advantage of all these resources and become the player he's capable of becoming.
So Robert Saleh joked in one of those answers about figuring out the wide nine spot. That's why Aaron White Cotton gets paid all that money. That's a joke, but there is a reason that Aaron Whitecotton gets paid all that money, and it's because of his ability to develop defensive linemen and his history of doing so. And I don't want to just limit this to defensive ends, but it's defensive linemen in general. Whitecotton has a track record of developing. First of all, he and Saleh have coached together for 8 years across different teams. And during those times when they were together, first-round pick Quinnen Williams turned him into an all-pro, perennial Pro Bowler. First time Quinnen Williams made the Pro Bowl was under Whitecotton's tuition. They take first-round pick Jermaine Johnson. He makes the Pro Bowl his second season in the league, 2023 season, the one I was just reading the stats from. Will McDonald posted 10.5 sacks last year under Aaron Whitecotton, second season in the league. I mean, that's three first-round picks Aaron Whitecotton had. That's high talent. You expect those guys to be good. Aaron Whitecotton got all three of them to double-digit sack season or Pro Bowl or both. Then there's guys that aren't first-round picks that he's developed. Guys like, I don't know, John Franklin Myers, a player that the Los Angeles Rams straight up waived from their roster. Jets picked him up. A year and a half later, after being coached by Whitecotton, he gets a four-year, $55 million contract from the Jets and then goes to the Broncos. Bryce Huff, the Jets signed as an undrafted free agent. They got 10 sacks out of him, 2023 with the Jets. And then he goes off and signs a $51 million contract and doesn't really do much afterwards when he gets away from Whitecotton. Whitecotton has a history of taking guys with athletic tools, whether they're first-round picks or undrafted free agents or free agents signed off the street, and turning them into extremely productive players in this defense. And I don't know if you want to credit that to Whitecotton or Saleh or whoever. I'm crediting it to both of them, and it doesn't matter because they're both on the Titans staff, obviously. And here's a video from Thursday's practice that Buck Rising took of Aaron Whitecotton running a drill. He's an absolute madman. The energy he brings to like a warm-up drill of individual development period. I've bleeped the F words here. I believe I had to bleep six of them in this video. I'm just playing it at a low volume in the background. But if you're watching on YouTube, shout out Buck for getting this video. This is just a taste of what Aaron Whitecotton brings as the leader of this position group. And I will say, everybody who was on hand, this is one thing we didn't go really deep into on Friday, but everybody who was on hand for this OTA practice in the Titans media came away talking about the energy brought to practice, not just by Aaron Whitecotton, also by Brian Daboll, which we'll talk about at some point, but that Aaron Whitecotton has an infectious energy as a position coach at these practices, and he's the guy tasked now with getting the most out of Femi Oladejo. There's a lot of positive influences here that lead us to say Femi Oladejo could have a breakout season. There's also a lot of competition in the room. Make or break for this Titans defense? Maybe that was a little extreme, but I'm really excited to see what Oladejo can do this year.
Yeah, I saw that Aaron Whitecotton clip and immediately said, oh, we're going to like this guy. I think all Titans fans are going to be pumped about having him. The more exposure we get to him as he's, you know, more and more open practices and training camp and things of that nature. But you summarized it. I think we'll end it there. Big year on deck for Femi Oladejo.
I think a lot of people are forgetting about Femi.
Not the Music City Audible. We didn't forget about Femi. We just did a near 40-minute episode on him as the subject. Excited for him, cautiously optimistic, but I also have some questions, concerns about his ability to maximize the opportunity he's about to get, but can't ask for a better one. Robert Saleh, Aaron Whitecotton, surrounded by talented teammates, Jeffrey Simmons, Jermaine Johnson, John Franklin Myers, getting to learn from Javon Kearse, one of the most decorated pass rushers in franchise history. It's all at the feet of Femi Oladejo. He's just got to bend down and pick it up. We'll see if he manages to do that this year. All the talent in the world certainly capable of taking that developmental step forward. This has been a pretty cool episode of the Music City Audible podcast. We'll be back tomorrow. We're not going to tell you what we're talking about. May or may not be the Tennessee Titans, but you'll have to tune in, I guess, to find out. Until then, y'all stay safe out there and tighten up.
A Broadway Sports Media production.